Well, it is brilliant for my latest nostalgia interview to interview the interviewer, my regular Thursday evening interviewer on KMTV. It's Sophia Aiken.
Hello, nice to be here.
Great to have you. So, of course, now we normally talk about film. And, of course, I've interviewed you on my film programme, and I'm sure we'll come on to that. There'll be a sliding doors moment, I'm sure. But, of course, you're a journalist here at KMTV. Do you want to say a little bit about Sophia, about what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So, when I started as a video journalist at KMTV about 2 years ago now, I got the job from doing a three-year undergraduate at the University of Kent, the Centre for Journalism, studying journalism. And what we did there was multimedia, so I learned basically all of the basics of TV, radio, print and online. And then in my third year, I did an internship at KMTV where I learned a lot there, really, learning how to put together a TV report, how to balance a story, how to make sure you're getting all the correct voices in, but also producing a piece that's different to perhaps what your competitors will be doing. So yeah, I started the internship, and then essentially once I graduated a year on, I was very lucky to be kept on, and now I'm the show's main anchor as well, which is, it's been brilliant. And
it's actually brilliant because what we do, of course, every Thursday, and I often don't know what question is going to be asked, which is kind of how I like it. Unless I'm asked a quiz question, sometimes I don't know. I have blind spots, as we all do. But also really good, because making it Kent specific is really important. And sometimes I'm surprised at how those connections can be made, because I'm not from Kent, and I live in Kent and go to the cinema in Kent. But it's kind of nice sometimes to sort of see, oh yeah, of course, this film links with something that the local community, the viewers, will be interested in. But is that something that you've really sort of picked up on, that the local character of everything that you do, the local flavour of KMTV, makes you see the world through a different kind of lens?
Well, as someone that's also not from Kent, I'm actually from Sussex. So when I first moved to Kent, I mean, of course, it's in the southeast, so I knew of Kent, I knew of parts of Kent. But when I first started to be a journalist in Kent, I think it's always daunting taking on a new patch, but it's also exciting because it gives you the chance to immerse yourself into the area, find out all these amazing facts about the county, find out a bit about the local politicians and what's changing in the area. So yeah, I think that's what's exciting, is that here at KMTV we just focus on Kent, so I think it's quite good to focus on one area, because you build up a really good list of contacts of some regular people that you can go back to and rely on. But also, as it's, you know, it's one of the, I think it might be the southeast's biggest county, potentially, there's always so much going on. You might think, well, you're only covering one part of the country, how are you always finding news to do? But there's always so much going on in Kent, especially because we're so close to London, we're near the Channel. There's never a slow day in news.
Yeah, and also, of course, sometimes, as I saw just the other week, because we're recording this, the morning after the general election was called, so anything can happen between now and indeed when this is put out. But I think it was just 2 weeks ago, there was a big news story of a defection from the Conservative Party to Labour, and that only came at lunchtime, actually, at Prime Minister's Questions. But within a matter of hours, because I'm assuming that you were here on Medway when it happened, and within a few hours, you're doing a live broadcast from the beach, I think, was it Dover? And of course, I recognised that, because I thought, I go to the cinema literally around the corner. In fact, was there, I think, just the following evening. So in that sense, I can see the real thrill, the adrenaline that must come from genuinely not knowing, not just what you're going to be talking about, but where you're going to be doing it from, and then doing it live as well.
Yeah, I think part of what I love about this job is no 2 days are the same. So every single day, I can go into work thinking, oh, I'm doing this story today, or I'm presenting the show, and it can just change like that. As we saw yesterday, I think we all came into work expecting, I actually wasn't at work, but you know, most people came into work not expecting that bombshell, and then there started being whispers that he could be calling the election in July, which I think came as a real shock to so many people, because many people were expecting it in the second half of the year. But absolutely, when that news broke a few weeks ago about Natalie Elphick, I was sat at my desk putting the show together, and then it was Prime Minister's Questions, and we heard the news there, and just all of a sudden, all of us in the newsroom were so shocked. Because if you know Natalie Elphick, she's classically a very right-wing conservative, so for her to defect to the Labour Party was a real shock. And our channel director, Andy, ran down the corridor, knocked on the newsroom door, and we were like, we know, and he was like, get to Dover. So I got in my car, dashed to Dover. There's definitely, when you're driving there, you've got some nerves, some adrenaline, and then when you get there, I think that adrenaline pushes you through to do the live. And then when it goes well, when the technology is on your side and you get some good voices, there's such a thrill from actually doing a good news piece.
And I have to ask, do you watch yourself back?
Sometimes I do. I mean, that one I wanted to watch back. And that one, you know what I was pleased with? Because unfortunately, I think we're always our own biggest critics, aren't we? Sometimes I watch my pieces back and I'm like, oh, I'm really disappointed in that one. But weirdly, sometimes the ones I'm most disappointed in are the ones that my news team around me think I've done really well on. So I think, yeah, you'll always be your own biggest critic. But I don't watch everything back because I think
But because you're on so often, that's the honest.
Exactly, I don't want to hear my own voice too much.
Yeah, but also it's important in terms of connecting with the audience, because I suppose sometimes when you're watching yourself back, and I found this at the very beginning, because I was a little bit more nervous, but I was aware that I was gesticulating a lot. And I was thinking, okay, well, it's not in itself a bad thing, but potentially distracting. And I was thinking, gosh, is that how I always come across maybe when I'm teaching? So you become more self-aware. And in that sense, I think that it's just being aware sometimes of how you project yourself. But you're right that sometimes we are our own worst critics.
Absolutely.
And that's why I'm always keen to put out, as I do on social media, my 3-minute clips every week, because also that's my way of saying, well, you know, whether it goes well or not, the whole point of that is that you kind of want people to give you feedback, like my students. You know, my students probably are, sometimes they're exhilarated if they get good feedback. If they don't get such a good mark, they may not. But there's always that chance for improvement. And I think that often we forget that actually we need that. It's not just, you know, in my case, my students. Sometimes I'm as much in need of feedback, because we're all on a journey. We're all being educated. Educators are also the ones being educated.
There's always room for improvement, and that's the beauty of live TV. You never kind of know what to expect. Sometimes you're just sort of winging it and you don't know what's going to come up. But yeah, I always welcome feedback. I mean, sometimes at the time it can be a bit of a blow if you've worked really hard on a story and it's perhaps not been received the way you want it to be. But I think often I can look back, reflect, and think, actually, that feedback was really valuable and it's taught me a lesson for next time. So I think most of the time, feedback allows us to grow and it can also toughen you up a little bit. So no, I absolutely always welcome that. And I think also giving yourself feedback. So that's why it's often good actually to watch back some of my pieces sometimes, because I can recognise, oh, why didn't I ask that question? Or why didn't I take this shot, for example? So I think, yeah, feedback is always welcome.
Yeah. And so you mentioned, of course, that you're from East Sussex, but and you went to University of Kent to do, so the journalism school is where you did your degree. So do you want to say a little bit about how you ended up at KMTV?
Yeah, so I'm from West Sussex, actually, but I know East Sussex so well, you know, Brighton, I'm always in Brighton. But yeah, so I've lived in a town called Haverseth my whole life. For those who don't know, it's a bit of a commuter town. It's in between Brighton and London. It's quite near to sort of Gatwick and Crawley. So born and bred there my whole life. Went to sort of primary school in my town, very close to me, you know, 5 minutes walking distance. It's one of those towns that's a cross between like town and rural, so it's kind of quite good, but then it's near to the beach, it's near to sort of the city as well. So yeah, I went there to primary school, and then my secondary school was about a half hour walk, so I was always encouraged to do lots of walking and sort of get my fitness in. But then for my college, funnily enough, I live opposite the road from a college, but I didn't want to go to that college, and my brother and sister have gone there, and I said I did my research, and I perhaps won't name the college, don't want to bring it down, but I'd done my research and I didn't sort of have faith in that college. So I'd spoken to my parents and I said, I want to go to a college in Brighton. It's called Basvic. And my dad was like, sort of like, you know, you're right opposite the road from this college, why don't you want to go there? And I fought my corner and they supported me, you know, they'll always have my back in the end. And yeah, at college, I then studied business, English literature and philosophy. And I actually did like a journalism course on the side, interestingly, because that was always my interest. So then doing those three, I enjoyed college. It was great to be in Brighton, but none of my three A levels I had a particular passion in pursuing. And journalism had always been in the back of my head. But I thought, because I hadn't done much journalism, I wasn't entirely sure if I wanted to commit to a degree. So what I did was take a year off, had a gap year. It wasn't the most exciting gap year. I didn't go, you know, on holiday or travelling. What I did was worked to save up money. And I did a little bit of work experience at my local paper, which was Sussex Living Magazine. Did that, did a bit, started my own blog, things like that, did a bit of practice. And then I'd actually spoken to the head of the Centre for Journalism at the time and told a bit, been honest with him and said, I'm actually, interestingly, having my doubts about whether I want to be a journalist because there's this financial commitment and I don't want to start this degree if I don't know if I'm going to enjoy it. And had a really good chat with him and ended up thinking, yeah, I'd like to study journalism. The reason I picked, because I looked at University of Kent, University of Sussex and Bournemouth, because obviously I live in Sussex, it made sense to look at that one. And the reason, actually, the kind of sway for me as to why I picked University of Kent was KMTV, because I'd seen the studio, the elaborate studio, and I'd seen kind of, I was like, wow, this would be really cool to have the chance to actually put together a show. And there was also the chance to do the NCTJ qualification, which I thought was really important. So that was why I chose that in the end. I wasn't sure about Kent because I hadn't massively been to Kent before. But I kind of wanted to go somewhere that was slightly away from home to kind of, I guess, find a new area, find something new. But I wasn't the sort of person that necessarily wanted to be really far away from home. So Kent, it's an hour from where I lived before, it seemed like the perfect choice, and I think I made the right decision.
Absolutely. Well, very clearly, because there's that term I often use called retrospective causality. I don't know, I think I invented it, but it's pretty obvious what it is. But it's that sort of thing, so you look back and say there's a pattern. And actually, Andy, the channel director, was my most recent guest on this programme. And for him as well, journalism wasn't something that he was overtly thinking of doing until he started doing it and realised that that was exactly it. And I suppose it's with a lot of professions that, we're doing a podcast. Well, podcasts didn't exist much more than 20, certainly 25 years ago. So, you know, they are wonderful. They're like, you know, the chance to do your own radio show without doing a proper radio show. But, you know, looking back, you think, wow, if these sort of things, if the technology had been there when I was growing up in the 1980s, for example, I would have loved to have done something like this. I'm not sure I want to listen back to that now. I suspect I would, you know, need a little bit of self-coaching. But when you're doing this, and I'm imagining the buzz, the liveness, you know, going on TV, doing a lot of, you know, often having to wing it sometimes, I would imagine, if a story is breaking while you're on air, and knowing that you can do it, knowing you've got those attributes, it's second to none, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, interestingly, when I actually started the degree, I wanted to be a print journalist. So I actually, my dream job was to write for a magazine. And then it was only when I kind of started the degree and got a taste of TV, and it was something about, I mean, the fact that, because we got the chance in my degree and at KMTV to be our own camera operator. So we had all the creative control to get all our own footage and kind of have that creative control of how we wanted to put the pieces together. As you said then, it's when I was doing it that I realised, oh, this is surprising actually. I'm liking TV a lot more than journalism, because I wouldn't say I was like massively shy when I was younger. I've always loved talking to people, but I didn't necessarily imagine myself on TV. I didn't kind of want to be in the limelight, which is interesting because now I do it, I absolutely love it and I prefer it so much more than writing. I think you can tell a story, in my opinion, you can tell a story, you know, in written words, but for me, it's when you can see the face of the interview, when you can see all the shots, I love being able to tell a story that way. And it's the fact that sometimes, you know, we'll be doing a pre-prepared story, or sometimes we'll be doing a live, like I did with the Natalie Elphick news. Sometimes I'll be presenting the show. I love the difference with TV. It's just so, that's what I like. It's, as much as I like routine, I also like not having a set routine. So that, I think that's why TV appeals to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I was thinking as well that in my case, I write film reviews, And I sort of do them as, I suppose in a way they're sort of like doing an academic article, but without the references. And also you're writing on something that you've just watched. You know, an article can take weeks or months sometimes, and it may be longer before it goes out. So it's that sort of immediate impact type thing. But also then, without having the script in front of you, going on TV, you might say, Chris, what have you seen in the course of the last week? And so what I have to do is distill that 500-word article. I might have 10 seconds to talk about that particular film, because I might want to talk about a few others as well. So it's that sort of sense of knowing that you can translate what you know in one context. Like students, I mean, some of my students have got exams today. They may spend weeks on their essays, but of course they have to do an exam under time conditions, and sometimes they do better work because it's spontaneous and because they're not worrying about, are they footnoting correctly, are they using the right convention. Here they just have to write what they know, and it doesn't matter if it's a bit rough and ready. In fact, that's actually better sometimes, because it's different from an essay where there are certain conventions that are requirements, and they'll lose marks if they don't follow them. So I suppose in that sense it's the blend, and also in your case, of course, you're processing news that may come from one outlet, or you might be watching Prime Minister's Question Time, and then within a few hours, you know, you might not have known anything about that story or that MP, you know, when the day started, but by the end, of course, you're speaking to people in the community, you're asking them questions about what's happened, and you become an expert on that, legitimately so, by 5:30.
Yeah, we were actually, interestingly, in the newsroom speaking about this the other day, the fact that most days we will have to teach ourselves something new. And I could start the day and get told, right, we want you to do a story on this today, and I'm like quite daunted, because I'm like, I know nothing about this. But you know, you do your research, you look at a few different articles, and then by the end of the day, I think you're quite amazed at what you know. You won't always know absolutely everything, but I think you're amazed at what you can quickly learn. And I think that's what's great is with this job, you're learning so much, and it gives you such a great understanding of what's going on in the world. And it teaches you to be really adaptable, because the other thing with this job, with TV, is you have to explain things in a simple way. With articles, it can be a little bit more in depth. You can use perhaps slightly bigger words. But with TV, you know, it has to be in a way that absolutely anyone, almost a child, could understand it listening to it. So I think it's thinking of all those things, like, right, how can I explain this load of jargon in a way that our viewers will understand? So sometimes it's really using simple language, short sentences, and making sure you're covering all the basics. So what, where, when, why, how, that sort of thing. So it's definitely a challenge, but it's exciting.
No, it is, because I find that sometimes, and it depends who your audience is, because when we have to write books as part of our job, then although often you're saying it's for the students, it's for the students of tomorrow. But in reality, you're also often writing it for your peers, because you're saying, hey, look, I've written this book. And there's often it's quite competitive, or there's that sense of, you know, who can get the best starred book for the next impact round. But sometimes when you're not doing that, and the thing that I've enjoyed most about doing some of the TV work is that I don't have to think about those. In fact, it's actually wrong to think like that. Because if I was to go on KMTV and sort of think that I have to be the most erudite, show-offy person there, then, well, I don't think I'd belong there. And what I enjoy is actually a different side of me, a more, not primal, but a more sort of like from childhood, a sort of the thing that got me into media in the first place, of hearing those live voices. I mean, for me, connecting to live radio particularly, you know, is something else, because you it's like somebody gave me the analogy once of being on a bus, actually even about the podcast, that it's like overhearing a conversation between two people, but you've arrived at your stop, you have to get off, but you're thinking, oh, I want to hear a bit more.
Yeah.
So you think, I may have a long walk back, but no, I have to see how this conversation plays out.
Yeah.
So for me, that adrenaline, I even find it with teaching to an extent, even if I've taught the same module every year, you know, the audience will be different. But I might give film examples. Like one year I mentioned the Bohemian Rhapsody film, the Freddie Mercury film, and they'd all like watched it. I mentioned it a year later and they had no idea what I was talking about, and I was just thinking, oh gosh. So and it made me feel very old, so I had to readapt as I was going on, and that was a good skill. But as I've mentioned film, then and as we've talked about film on the programme, I can't get away without asking about whether film or music, for example, were quite influential on you when you were growing up.
I think naturally everything you consume has got to have some sort of influence on you, whether you know it or not. I mean, you know, my favourite film is Harry Potter. I'm sure you've not forgotten that. That's something, it must have had an influence on my life. I have watched it since I was a child, and even now when I watch it, it takes me back to being a child. And I saw this debate the other day of people saying, why are adults enjoying Harry Potter? It's for children. And I was like, no, absolutely not. I think that's like when you're growing up, you'll start to enjoy different films and films that perhaps you wouldn't have enjoyed when you were younger. But I think you can still have a place in your heart for those films that you liked, because especially when you're a child, that's when your brain is developing and that's when you're learning these things. So I think there are probably films I wouldn't watch now that I would have enjoyed when I was younger, but I'm still a sucker for Harry Potter, Disney, because it makes me feel nostalgic.
Yeah, and do you find that when you watch them later, does the magic, I mean, there's sort of lots of ways of looking at this, does the magic retain, is the magic lost a bit, or is it enhanced? Because, like, in a way, you've grown up with the films.
Well, what's interesting is because I think when you're a child, you're just watching, you're not necessarily paying attention to the storyline or anything like that. But then when I watch it now, I'm like, oh, I never noticed that about this film. Or you learn, because I've watched it, you know, so many times, I'm like, oh, that's like a little hint to what's going to be happening later, a little bit of foreshadowing. So, yeah, it's definitely interesting. But there are, some films I'm trying to think of some, for example, but some films I loved when I was younger, and then I'm like, oh, let's watch it now I'm older, and I'm like, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, because I don't really enjoy it anymore.
Well, I had somebody on the film programme who watched the night before going on the programme one of the films that she'd selected, and she said, you know, it was really hard to whittle it down to four films, but she managed to do it. And then she watched the film, and she said to me, you know, but obviously it was too late to change it at that point. She said, actually, I watched it last night, and actually, I didn't like it. And she said, I wish I'd chosen, I think she said, A Few Good Men. and I was like, well, I could talk about that film, but obviously it wasn't your choice, so we won't do that. But it's interesting when that happens, that sometimes we all do it. But also, I suppose we grow up to the point that, like in your case, you know you're not going to ever grow tired of Harry Potter, because you know what you're going in to expect. It's not like, if you haven't seen it in 20 years, you might be disappointed, but I'm guessing that you watch sufficiently often that you watch it because you know it's going to fit a particular niche.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I think when you're, it still has that same impact, and somehow I just don't get bored of it, even though I've you know, watched it so many times. But yeah, I think the great thing about Harry Potter and fantasy is it's escapism. It's feeling like for a second you're entering a different world. But I mean, I love fantasy. I love, like, Lord of the Rings, but I quite like to watch different films as well that perhaps will take me by surprise. So there are certain films that I'm like, oh, I'm not going to enjoy that. And then I come away and I'm like, oh, I really liked that. So I really like psychological thrillers as well. I've always liked like a rom-com. I think probably my least favourite type of film is probably like an action film. Actually, no, I take that back. My least favourite is horror. I can't watch horror films just because I'm too much of a scaredy cat. But I try to be really open-minded with films, because I think you can take yourself by surprise, and it's nice to try different things. So I don't only watch Harry Potter, I'll make that clear.
No, but also because the one that sticks in mind is Sliding Doors. Because, and interesting as a journalist, because I think we may have touched on this in the interview that we did on Kent Film Club, because, you know, you're interested in the genre that in a way is a good counterpoint to that, because I suppose as a, you know, you could have gone for All the President's Men, or you could have gone for all sort of like investigative journalism stories, but actually going for something which touches the heart in a different sort of way, that, you know, and I like that. I think we all have that element, that whether it's in our music or films, that sometimes the things that excite us are not the things that maybe in our day job people associate us with. Because, I mean, Sliding Doors is a really good example. I saw it when it came out in 98. And that sort of notion, which connects so well, that, you know, what if we had two glimpses of a life, or what if there were two parallel ourselves? Because often, as later on, I sometimes think, gosh, I've almost like caught up with a different strand of my earlier self. Like, you know, when I was young, I would have thought, you know, to be on TV every week would have been like the pinnacle of the dream. And then suddenly, when I turned 50, I was doing that, but it's almost as though I was on a different, like Back to the Future, the deviant timeline. Actually, Gabriel chose Back to the Future when he was on the programme. And that sort of notion of having a deviant line almost, the sort of the transgressive line, the alternative line. But then at some point, somehow, those lines connect, and suddenly the real line, or the linear line, ends up being the one that actually you no longer really associate with your authentic self. So films can give you that possibility.
Yeah, because what I love so much about Sliding Doors is it's because it's a concept I always think about. So I'm like, if I was to walk to this location rather than drive, would I stumble across and meet somebody that becomes my best friend, or, you know, something like that? Or if I was to drive, you know, would something else happen? So I think it's just because it's something I'm always thinking about, the what ifs. And yeah, it is that like concept of, is there a kind of a fate and a sort of something already set out for me that no matter what path I take, I will end up coming back to that? Or is every single decision going to have such a different impact that it's going to change your future? I just always find that so interesting. Like, every decision you have can have such a big impact. Even, you know, my bigger decisions like coming to the University of Kent, and smaller decisions like what you had for breakfast. So interesting.
But often those small decisions, I mean, I find it with my children as well, that often, like, the issue about what they're having for breakfast, the funny thing is, they matter to them more than what we might call the big things. Actually, the funny thing is, when we have a guest on in the studio, the question is always just to make sure the mic is working, what do you have for breakfast? But actually, with my children, they have a go. If I give them too little milk or something, it's not just, you know, can I have more milk? It's like, screaming, and they're comparing, you know, you got more milk than mine. I'm thinking, this is a nonsense conversation. But to them, it really matters. And yet, sometimes, like, if I'm on TV, you know, they never watch me. You know, but for them, it's like, you're on TV, like, that's weird. You know, they get there and they're not interested. But they will fight over who's got which kind of wine gums or whatever it might be. And I'm thinking, this is crazy. But it's interesting that when you're older, sometimes you see things differently. But I find through keeping a diary that sometimes the things I record might be, you know, bizarrely, like, sometimes you think of all the things that go on in one's life, but you might capture, like, you know, for breakfast I had broccoli and carrots with my meal. You're like, this is ridiculous. Like, why did I? But in a funny way, those incidental things. Yeah. Interestingly, build up a picture, but, you know, but actually, are the things that sort of day to day really matter? Sometimes the bigger picture we perhaps generate later on, and often do it retrospectively. And we often get, I think, the micro level and the macro level kind of a bit confused.
Well, the interesting thing about breakfast is it is typically the first thing you do. So I am not one of those people that skips breakfast. Yeah. Maybe very occasionally I will always have a coffee, but I am a big believer in it's the first thing that you're going to do. So you need to do it right, because if you're not having breakfast, that sets a bad precedent for the rest of the day. You're not going to have energy. And that actually could impact the rest of your decisions. It could make you more tired when you're driving to work. It could make you more lethargic. So I am a big believer in that. And there's also that interesting thing of, you should always make your bed the first thing you wake up, because it's the first task that you've done successfully. So, I mean, probably 4 out of 5 times I will make my bed straight away. But I am a big believer in that, in kind of the small decisions you make can, not always, but can often have a really big impact on the rest of your day, and then your day can have an impact on, say, that week, that month, that year. So it is, it's interesting.
But also, they're not unrelated, because you just made me think, I'm going back to the sliding doors example, but actually, because I go on the tube every Saturday with my daughter, and often other children as well, if they want to come along, if they want a day out in London, often they don't. And we often have to wait for the tube on the Jubilee line to come along to take us. And when we're there, sometimes we have to let one or even two trains go, because they're crowded. And we're thinking sometimes that, okay, well, if there's one a minute later, it's okay. But sometimes you wait and you're thinking, oh no, you know, we've missed the point and we're going to be late. And there was one week when we just missed the train, thought it was fine, there's one along in 3-4 minutes, it's not the end of the world. And then we got as far as the next station, I think it was London Bridge, and then the doors opened, people got off, people got on, and nothing happened 5 minutes later. This is a bit odd. Turned out there'd been some suspected, I think it may have been a fire, but it wasn't a fire, but a suspected fire at Canary Wharf. So suddenly our day was completely scuppered. But if we'd just got that train, if we'd hurried, the outcome would have been different.
It's a classic sliding doors.
And
it is.
So, and I always think of what you said in the programme about that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at the time you're thinking, well, does it matter, you know, whether you get on this carriage, that train. But actually, every week, I have a different adventure. One time I was on the train, and I was convinced that a former student of mine was in the carriage. And I think she was probably thinking, oh my goodness, she was with her parents. But I thought, that's my lecturer. And I didn't want to sort of, you know, pry. But I was thinking, how weird, of all the places, and she was from West Wales as well, thinking of all the places, of all the times, you encounter people in the most unexpected place. But you're thinking, but what are the chances that I'm here at this moment? Is it fate? Is it destiny?
Yeah.
And you don't, and then suddenly you've got effectively the ingredients of a perfect rom-com.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, actually. I'm thinking, because my best friend at the moment is in Australia, and she told me that she saw a girl from school in Australia. And I was like, what are the chances of that? But then when you think about it, actually, you know, if someone's going travelling, and, you know, my friend Phoebe, she's gone through this, this like, organised thing. If this other girl from our school has also gone through this organised thing, perhaps it's not so odd that they'd be in the same nightclub. So I think it is interesting, but I do always like to think, yeah, I love a rom-com at heart. So that classic storyline of these two people destined to meet and ending up on the same tube, but then I'm also like, well, or is it just a coincidence? Because I am sometimes a little bit cynical and logical, but I do like to think that sometimes, like, you're meant to be somewhere for that specific reason, and you're meant to, you know, you are meant to meet people, but it's one of those things that you can always debate, isn't it?
Yeah, because sometimes when those unexpected things happen, you look for patterns, but when they don't happen, and 9 times out of 10 they don't, like, most days don't have those sliding doors moments, yeah. or if they do, we're not aware of them, because that's the whole point. But I was on a train once, and I was writing up an old diary, and it was from 2000. So this was about 15 years later. And it was the time when, back to what we think about politics, actually, when the Labour Party was having a bit of a tussle about who would be the mayor of London, their candidate, you know, Ken Livingstone, Frank Dobson. And I was writing about that, and something must have affected me enough, because it was like, wow, London's going to have a mayor, and, you know, the official candidate may not be the one who's you know, the one that the party wants, etc., or the leader wants, and all the rest of it. And I was on the train, and I'm not joking, I put my diary down, and I just write of all the things randomly. It was like February 2000 when that particular entry referring to the upcoming election. Put it down, literally put it down, and just, you know, staring into the distance. And a man came out the buffet car, and I thought, oh, it looks a bit like Frank Dobson, ha ha ha. Came closer. It was Frank Dobson.
That's so strange.
But I couldn't say to him, oh, I was just writing. Yeah. That would have been really freaky. So I couldn't say anything. I think I went straight to my parents and said, you'll never believe what just happened. But you're thinking, you know, that seems a bit too, you know,
chances?
What are the chances? And then, of course, you start looking for them. And I think I have enough of them, enough stories like that to make me think, well, if I wanted to write like a screenplay, you know, I would just, you know, easily do that. Yeah. But of course, if you talk about that too often, people might think, oh, you know, you're getting a bit mystical, or you know, as a journalist, sometimes people think, well, you know, you need hard facts, or sometimes that sort of stuff doesn't belong in that kind of world.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting. That's so random that you happen to see him as you were writing about him. You probably know all about, like, manifestation. I was, like, just thinking, well, perhaps you manifested it when you were writing about him, you manifested it, or perhaps it's just a massive coincidence, because I'm sure that every other day you wrote in your diary about other people and you didn't end up seeing them. So I imagine the chances are very slim, but I imagine that's just... Yeah. An interesting coincidence. Yeah.
Well, what I'll have to start doing now is writing up next week's winning lottery numbers.
Yeah, please tell me.
Yeah, exactly. And then that
would make a fortune.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Mystic Meg, Mr. Chris. Yeah. And another thing about, like, teachers who inspired you as well, because along the way, because, you know, there's nothing better than when one of my students might say, you know, and often it might be something that I've forgotten about, it might be from several years earlier, and they'll often say, you know, thanks to a particular class or, you know, a session, that they saw the world through a different lens. I've had students who've studied a particular theorist, yeah. like a theologian, and then they were inspired to write to that person, something I'd never done, and they said to me, by the way, and he got back to me, he emailed me, and he said, he's happy to meet, and I'm thinking, hang on a minute, you know, this was from a topic, you know, in my class. But if you had any of those sort of moments where somebody has made you see the world differently and started you or got you on the journey that you're on now?
Well, I was trying to think about this, and I think that teachers who have inspired me more stem to mind later in my life. So I've got to mention Rob Bailey, my lecturer at the University of Kent. He actually, funny enough, interviewed me for the position as a student here. And throughout, I mean, I was studying during COVID, so that's something I think no lecturer, as you all know, can prepare for. And all the lecturers were brilliant during the pandemic, but Rob was always, you know, second to none. He really adapted his sort of teaching style. Bear in mind, you know, your students are having to learn via Teams or Zoom, and that's something they're not prepared for. And I think your attention span can quickly go. But I just always thought his teaching style was really interesting, and always, you know, kept me really engaged, and he still always put his all into it. So yeah, I mean, Rob was always great throughout, always gave incredible feedback. Even when he wasn't my direct mentor, he would make the effort to, you know, looking at my work and helping me with that. So then to go on to work with him at KMTV was great. And the other person that springs to mind was when I was at college and I was studying philosophy. My teacher Tom, I always thought he was great as well. And I think what was great was that his style, you know, some teachers you can feel like perhaps you can't tell them everything and you feel like they're above you. Mm-hmm. But with Tom, it always felt like you were at a level with him, and almost not like he was your friend, but almost like you could tell him anything and he wouldn't get annoyed at you. He'd give you really constructive criticism. And philosophy was such a fascinating subject, but it was so difficult. And I studied it at GCSE, so to jump to A-level, it was so different. And I really struggled with kind of parts of it. While I found it interesting, I struggled with kind of the analysis, the essays we had to do. And Tom really helped me with that and kind of gave me one-on-one time to help me through it. And I ended up, you know, not doing too bad in the end. So yeah, he stands out to me. Yeah.
But I have to ask about Rob, because they both sound incredibly influential people. But because I've seen you interviewing Rob, or Rob interviewing you, because yeah. You did the local elections, didn't yes. you, just a few weeks ago. Were you in Maidstone?
We were in Tunbridge Wells. Yeah. That's the crazy thing that Rob and I always said was he was my lecturer, and then I was the producer of the politics show. There was this almost shift, and it was so strange because he went from sort of telling me what to do to me sort of telling him what to do, which was really, really strange. But I think we worked really well as colleagues. It's always been so fun. Rob did the politics show for a year and a half, and he's a former journalist, so he's got, you know, a massive background in journalism for the Ken Messenger, actually. But he hadn't really done any broadcasts, so I always thought, and it's the same with you, like, you guys are brilliant presenters, and I always thought that it was so much fun to work with Rob. And then yeah, to go to the local elections, which was very stressful actually, because they ended up announcing the count like 2.5 hours late, and we were getting closer and closer to our show. And not only were we going live from the count, we were presenting our entire show from the count. So we usually would present from the studio and maybe throw to a reporter at a count, but we were presenting the entire show from the count. So we were like, what happens if we go live and we have no results in? And to be honest, we were kind of pretty close to that. I think they started, because of course they have to verify the votes first, I think they started counting about 2:30. Our politics show starts at 5, so we were starting to get a little bit stressed, because also the candidates didn't want to talk to us until their wards had been announced. So what ended up happening was, I think in that moment you have to think, right, we're presented with a difficult situation, how do we handle this? So Rob and I knew that we could just discuss it between the pair of us, do a bit of analysis. So what we did was basically announce what had currently been declared. And I think there were 4 wards out of, I think, 19 that had been declared at that point. So what we did was discuss what we knew. And I think that's the nature of news. You're live there. People expect that. And then we had one candidate that very kindly spoke to us. And then there was also a local democracy reporter who we spoke to. So I think we worked with what we had. And we also had Gabriel in Maidstone. So it ended up perhaps not how we'd planned, but I think we were really happy with the result.
Yeah, and also I think what the audience will do is feed off that sort of enthusiasm, because at the end of the day, the fact that there isn't news is news. Mm. You know, it's the anticipation for news. Although, I mean, we've just launched into a general election campaign. We're going to have, is it 6 weeks now of all of this? Oh, of 6 weeks of utter speculation. And then there will be a result eventually. And of course, there may be an immediate result, or as happened in a recent election, you know, 2010, it took a little while for the new government to be set up, so it's all of those sort of unexpected, you know, elements which as a journalist must be like super exciting, a bit scary perhaps, because you know that, you know, you really don't know what's going to unfold in the coming weeks.
It's so exciting, you do get a real buzz, but don't get me wrong, it's scary as well. I mean, when I started my career, so much happened in such a short space of time. There was Boris Johnson resigned, and then Liz Truss came in, and then Rishi Sunak, and in that year the Queen also died. There was so much going on. So I think the new cohort of journalists, we all started at a similar time. We came to expect, we kind of got thrown right into the deep end, so we learned to quite quickly adapt. And I think just learning how to respond to breaking news, it's something that's got easier over the years. And I think it's not being afraid to say, look, we don't actually know much at this point, but this is what we do know. We'll keep you updated. And I think our viewers can expect that, because that's what all the nationals do as well. You can't make up news if there's no news. That's all we know so far.
And you just made me think as well, it's an element of the tail wagging the dog, because before we had 24-hour news, then there wasn't the same sort of clamour. You know, and often there may be, you know, a print journalist might write a really good story, and they can write it. It may get published a week later, but it's still timely. Mm. I saw yesterday in the news that in The Spectator, someone, was it Fraser Nelson, had written a piece about why there shouldn't be an election this summer. Wow. And of course, before it was announced, he was then saying, this is my piece for tomorrow, because of course, by the time it would have come out this morning, people would have said, well, it's dated.
Yeah.
And he probably only wrote it yesterday. So, but there's that tail wagging the dog. Now we're in 24-hour news, then there's almost that sort of expectation that the big story yesterday was almost the, you know, the issue about almost like the wink of an eye, or the blink, or you know, or a nudge, or the way that somebody's hand movements were in terms of whether there would be an election. But it was like, well, this story could be killed off. But suddenly, you know, we didn't know there was going to be an announcement, but everyone was saying, well, hang on, well, then why is David Cameron, the Foreign Secretary, being recalled from Albania, and why can't Grant Shapps go to on an overseas trip? So suddenly it was like, well, you put it all, you know, in themselves, they're isolated, maybe not in their insignificant events, put them all together, and suddenly you have a story. And then at 5 o'clock, you know, then it was, we think it's going to be the 4th of July, and it was. But all these things came, you know, over the course of a few hours. That could never have happened in the days of Clement Attlee or Harold Wilson, or even, to be honest, Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, we've come a long way. I mean, and I mean, we produce a half-hour show every day, so I think it's trying to fit all of that in, and of course, keeping it hyper-local. I mean, as I said, I actually wasn't here yesterday, but our lead story was going to be the fact that Craig McKinley, the South Thanet MP who had sepsis, that was going to be our lead story, the fact that he was returning to Parliament after an 8-month battle with sepsis. And then all of a sudden, it's, whoa, now we've got a general election. Of course, we still mention Craig, but it is so interesting, the fact how quickly news changes. And I think that's why it's important we do a live show, because if we'd pre-recorded it, and then suddenly the news broke about a general election, it's kind of very dated. So news can date really quickly.
And I was thinking the same thing as well, because we had the blood contamination scandal story, and then the post office inquiry, which is still ongoing, and then you see the bionic man, the bionic MP, and then the news of the election. And these were all happening literally in rotation. In fact, if you go onto any sort of news site, BBC or whatever, you know, you're going to find all these stories are still kind of coalescing, but obviously some of them are trumping others for understandable reasons in terms of what's happening. But we've only got a few minutes to go, but because I have to ask, but this is our breaking news. This will go out today, but you have some wonderful news. You're going to the BBC.
I am. I still can't quite believe it. I'll be starting at the BBC mid-June. I'm going to be working as a journalist for BBC South East. I'm so excited. I've had such an incredible few years at KMTV, where I feel like I've learned so much, and I've had so many incredible opportunities. So to be working, you know, just down the road in Tunbridge Wells, in the same patch, but further into the southeast, where I've been born and bred, I'm so excited. But I won't be a stranger. I'll still be at KMTV, and I value what I've learned here so much.
Absolutely, and I always finish my interviews with this question, which fits very well with the nostalgia theme, as to whether you would consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person. And it's a good question to ask, but you're at this moment, you know, we've got election coming up, you've got a new job, obviously we've been reflecting on the things like Harry Potter that you grew up with, but you know, looking back, looking forward, are they opposites, are they sort of different sides of the same coin?
I'm going to be a little bit on the fence, because I think I do a bit of both. I think something slightly annoying that I'm trying to work on is being too overly self-critical about decisions I've made and things that I've done in the past, when actually I think I should be thinking about what I've learned from that and how I can, I guess, use that to perhaps not make that mistake again, or what I can do in the future. But I think, I'm trying to think what I do more. I probably think more about the past, actually, because I'm thinking of things that have happened to me or decisions that have kind of shaped me. But at the moment, I think I am thinking about the future with the news of the general election coming, which will be a couple of weeks after I start at the BBC, which is crazy, and kind of yeah, with all these things coming up, I think at the moment, weirdly, yeah, I'm thinking more about the future.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll see lots more of you, and it'd be interesting to return to this conversation. Indeed, when it goes out, and you know, yeah. who knows what will be going on in the
exactly.
world? News changes very fast. But Sophia, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been really fun.